This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with the new Ball State University president, Jeff Murins. He's going to talk about the transformation of the university in Muncie and how it's going to be one to keep an eye on in the months ahead. They've also rolled out a new brand and a subsequent advertising campaign. We'll find out more about that. Joining us in the studio will be Wally DeRose. He's worked as a special agent for the U.S. State Department and in other tasks as well here in Northwest Indiana, as well as involved in law enforcement. And we'll talk with him about his interest and his involvement as one of the caucus candidates for Lake County Sheriff. And later, we'll also have the conversations with the two superintendents, in Hobart and Hammond, as the voters are at the polls today in the special referendum. Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. WalletHub.com's turned out the latest report on the 2018 Best Colleges. Let's see how Indiana colleges fared in the list. And for that, we turn to analyst Jill Gonzalez. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Some great news for Indiana colleges and universities. How did WalletHub.com come up with the data to make up the list?
We looked at over 25 different metrics, some probably more familiar with than others, things like admission rates, student selectivity, what the incoming ACT or SAT scores look like, of course, costs and financing, student-to-faculty ratio. But then we did a deeper dive in terms of, was it all worth it? What do median salaries look like after attending whatever colleges or universities we looked at? What do student loan default rates look like? So really the career outcomes here as well.
So what does the best list for 2018 show as far as Indiana schools are concerned?
Well, nationally, Notre Dame actually ranked 16th out of the over 1,000 colleges and universities we looked at. Purdue ranked 84th, so still up there in the top 100. And as far as Indiana schools themselves, obviously Notre Dame number one here, Purdue number two. After that, DePaul, Wabash, and Hanover.
Mm-hmm. When you take a look at these figures, and based on the data and what you put together in coming up with the report, what seemed to be one of the important things that people can take away when they take a look at this list and see the top 10 colleges and universities in Indiana? Should they look out for that matter, say that they have somebody who's interested in going to college? Why should they choose this college over another?
I think that the career outcomes are really important now more than ever here. We want to make sure that there's a high percentage from these colleges that are earning above, say, what an associate's degree holder would make, what a high school graduate would make. We also want to see that, again, the bang is worth the buck here and that the student loan default rate is low. Mm-hmm. And across these colleges, Notre Dame, for instance, the student loan default rate, meaning the students that are unable to keep up with their student loans, is under 1%. Most schools on here are under the 3 to 5% level. So for the state of Indiana, that is really good news.
Now, in the lower half of the list, number 8 was Indiana University's Bloomington campus. Butler University, which is a private college in Indianapolis, came in 9th. And Valparaiso University got on the list at number 10.
Out of the 31 Indiana schools we looked at, the ones faring near the bottom were University of Southern Indiana, Indiana State University, and Holy Cross College.
I see.
And there, I would say, a lot of times we're not seeing graduates earn that much more than high school graduates. So I think that's really where the difference lies.
When you take a look at the overall list here and the chance to review all of these schools in coming up with the Indiana list, was there anything in particular that you all noted there at WalletHub.com that was of interest that we probably should know about?
Well, in some states we see an interesting divide between public schools and private schools. In Indiana, we didn't see that as much. It's kind of all over the place. And that usually is good for the state itself, that there's not this real divide between public and private learning.
Now, if anybody is interested in looking at the big list, how can they find out now?
Head to WalletHub.com and the 2018 College and University Rankings.
Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for WalletHub.com, and we're looking at the list of 2018's best colleges. The big list of all of the colleges in the country is on the website, but the Indiana list here shows that Notre Dame and the Purdue University West Lafayette campus came in number one, number two of the list there, and a lot of other universities did very well in that top 10 list. Jill, thanks for being with us to talk about it. We hope to have you back on soon.
Anytime.
And one of those universities that ranked very well in the WalletHub.com survey and the listing of the best colleges in Indiana is been run by our next guest here on the program. Jeff Murns is now the 17th president of Ball State University in Muncie. He's taken that position here, coming over from across the Ohio River from Northern Kentucky University. And President Murns, thank you for joining us here on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate your time.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with you and your work as in academia as well as being a university president, take a few moments and tell us about yourself.
Well, I took a somewhat unusual path to becoming an administrator in higher education. I spent more than 15 years of my career first as a trial lawyer. I was a federal prosecutor with the United States Department of Justice and then in private practice in Cleveland. When I was given the opportunity to be the dean of the law school at Cleveland State University and was there for a few years, including dean of the law school and then provost. And then for the previous 5 years, I was the president of Northern Kentucky University, which, as you said, is just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati, just a couple hours away from Muncie, Indiana.
Do you think that your experience being the president of NKU kind of got you ready for going to Ball State, or do you find in taking the position as the new president at Ball State University that it's different and more challenging, perhaps?
Well, it certainly is different. Every institution has a different vision and a different culture, but I think my experience both as a lawyer and my experience as president of NKU have given me the skills and experiences to prepare me for this opportunity and for those challenges. And I think one of the things that experience prepared me to do is to spend the first 6 months, which is about how long I've been on the job, spending that first 6 months listening and learning from our people on campus and people out in the community. I think it's important for me to get a good foundation of knowledge about the people and the programs before I help develop the plan for the future of the institution.
In the time that you've spent there in Muncie and being getting familiar with the campus, what do you think are some of the things that you have learned about Ball State University that you would tell others who maybe are not familiar with the institution?
Well, we certainly have a beautiful campus. We have it's a large institution, a diverse institution, about 190 different academic programs and majors. But one of the things I would say is I think it's the perfect size. We are a large, comprehensive university with great academic offerings and arts and culture and Division I athletics, but also we're small enough that students know each other and that our faculty and staff are capable of providing a personal educational experience to all of our students. So one thing I'd say is it's just the right size. The campus is beautiful. We're adding some new academic programs. We've got wonderful residence halls. And one of the things that I think is distinctive about our university culture is our commitment to certain enduring values that are represented by that iconic statue, Beneficence, which has graced our campus for many generations.
Mm-hmm. Not only have we had a chance for you to contact us and have a chance to be here on Lakeshore Public Radio, but to talk a little bit, too, about the latest effort, the new branding for Ball State University, just been announced yesterday, and the very ambitious advertising campaign that goes along with it. Tell us, if you will, what We Fly refers to and how this, you hope, is going to be sure to put the brand of Ball State University in front of more people and for a lot longer.
So we decided to embark upon this campaign because, frankly, we had been, as an institution, probably for the last few years, a little too quiet, a little too modest. And we all recognize that humility is an admirable trait in a person, but it's not necessarily a good marketing strategy for an institution, a university, or a business. So we're embarking on a campaign to tell the great story of our university and the great stories of our people, our faculty, our staff, our students, and our graduates. We're going to tell those stories with the passion and pride that those stories deserve. The reason we chose We Fly, really there are two reasons. One is it symbolizes our bold aspirations. You know, our students come to our campus with their own aspirations, with their own ambitious dreams, and we have an ambitious vision for the future of the university. And so those are two words that symbolize our commitment to something special, to something truly distinctive. The words We Fly are also representative of the two most prominent visual symbols of the university, the statue Beneficence, which I mentioned a moment ago, and also on the sports fields and on the courts, our mascot is the cardinal. So visually and verbally, it's consistent with those two longstanding images. So we're excited about the brand. We launched it yesterday with some exciting performances from some of our students, and it was an exciting day on our campus. And we're, as I said, we're going to tell our story with some energy and pride.
I feel kind of sorry for the folks with physical plant having to clean up all the mess after the celebration yesterday, but that's all right. It's part of the job. It comes with the job, and especially when you talk about the plans that you have to be able to make sure that Ball State University is front and center in front of everybody's eyes and minds as well. It's certainly not been difficult for alumni. The Alumni Magazine every single month has some great stories about students and people involved, faculty and staff, who have shown their dedication to the university, and the students in particular that have an opportunity to take what they've learned in the classroom, turn it into something interesting. And I doubt that probably there have been few other universities that have been able to use the term experiential learning to more important use than Ball State University has. The students always have been encouraged, pardon me, to go out there and get your classes in other areas, get your experience in other areas outside of the university, and put that to use in their lives.
That's right. And Chris, we are proud of the fact that in addition to imparting knowledge, in addition to giving our students an opportunity to apply what they learn in the classroom and acquire certain skills, that we believe we take experiential learning to another level with immersive learning. That is, we give students an opportunity working in collaborative teams under the guidance of our faculty. We give them an opportunity out in the community, out in the real world, to develop real solutions for real people and real institutions. And we think those immersive learning opportunities and all of the broad experiential learning opportunities truly prepare our students to have successful careers. And with the emphasis that we have on those enduring values, we also think we prepare our students very well to lead meaningful lives. So the education we provide not only transforms their lives, but it gives them the skills and the ability and the values to take the gifts that they've received to transform the lives of others.
I know that you and your wife have spent little time, just dawdling around the community, that you're getting familiar with the Muncie community at large, and you're doing things, I understand, too, in particular, is I've created opportunities to help transform the Muncie community with a new series of scholarships. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so one of the things that I learned in my first few months on campus was that the current conditions in Muncie and in Delaware County are a little bit of a headwind when we're trying to recruit students or faculty and staff. So I think we all recognize on our campus that we have an obligation as well as an interest, a self-interest, to support our friends and neighbors in Muncie. So in September and October, I participated in 3 community forums. We got off campus out into the community. We had forums on education, one on arts and culture, and one on economic development. And it was an opportunity for me to listen, to hear what it is that we could do to support the community, to make it a more vibrant civic and arts environment, what we could do to improve Muncie schools, what we could do to improve economic development. Now the challenge is, after having received some good ideas, some good suggestions, my responsibility to turn those suggestions into a series of concrete actions. And Jennifer and I also felt, as a part of that commitment, that we personally should demonstrate to the community our willingness to invest in the future. And so we have created a scholarship for students who graduate from Muncie Central High School and choose to attend Ball State. We understand that education has transformed our lives, and we feel that we are fortunate and want to share that good fortune to provide those opportunities to our friends and neighbors and to their children in Muncie.
Well, it's great to hear. We're always appreciative for you to spend some time to talk with us here in Northwest Indiana. We know there are a number of Ball State University grads, young people and old guys like us. Full disclosure, I just passed my 40th anniversary of having gotten my bachelor's from Ball State University, and still remember today sitting out there in the chairs outside the art museum out in the lawn, listening to the speaker at the time. And I think it was President John Preuss, if I recall right. So that tells you how long it's been. But it's always proud to have a chance to find out how my alma mater is doing, and a lot of people's alma mater as well, too. And we appreciate you taking time to talk with us today, President.
Well,
Burns.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and hopefully you can come back to campus. Next year, we're going to begin to celebrate our centennial. So I look forward to welcoming you back to Ball State.
I'll make that note, too. We've been talking with the new Ball State University president, Jeff Mearns. And as always, as you get it, I'm sure every day, chirp, chirp. You know.
Those thank you.
Those
chirp,
have to
chirp,
say
and
that
fly.
Too. Okay. Thank you very much, and we appreciate you talking today, sir. Our next guest is a fellow who's a native of Gary. He graduated from Emerson High School, has an interesting career, not only in law enforcement, but related fields as well. And not only that, but you wouldn't want to tussle with this guy. He's a Golden Glove boxer. We're talking about Wally DeRose. Wally has also just recently been involved in experiencing what it's like to run at least in some small way for public office. Wally, thank you for joining us here in Ridgely Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me here.
The reason I refer to public office, Mr. DeRose was one of the candidates when the Democratic Party precinct committee members got together here not long ago to choose a successor for Lake County Sheriff. He was one of those many people. There were quite a few people that were on the list of candidacies, interested candidates, I should say, for the position. And if you will, tell us what inspired you to decide that you were going to give it a go, be involved in the caucus for sheriff?
Well, I saw a list of candidates, and I thought that my qualifications met or even exceeded those other candidates that were in the caucus. So I thought, well, I'll give it a whirl. I used my training and experience gleaned at the international and local levels to help change the sheriff's department and super improve it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you got involved as a candidate and had a chance, I guess, to express yourself, I guess, though, it was in writing, though. You didn't have a chance to, nor did any of the people involved in the caucus seeking the sheriff's position had a chance to speak publicly at the caucus, but you had a chance to at least let the committee members know a little bit about yourself ahead of time.
Yeah, I did. It was like a three-sentence form that you had to fill out, two-page form, and really didn't go into any depth. But I did have an opportunity to meet a lot of nice people at the caucus itself and to familiarize myself with the procedures that they go through.
Do you think that there's a possibility that maybe that this will inspire you to, if not run for sheriff again, when the position comes up here in the primary election next year?
Well, that thought has entered my mind. In fact, a number of people have contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in taking that step forward in the general election, and I am considering it.
Let's go back to your times as a student in the Gary Community Schools and your graduation from Emerson High School and what you did that inspired you to go on not only for higher education purposes, but your career working overseas as well and in the United States here.
Well, I graduated from Emerson High School, and it was a wonderful high school. And during that period of time, I was active in boxing. And as a result of contacting Ray Zale, Tony Zale's nephew, I had an opportunity to obtain a scholarship to Wisconsin University. Unfortunately, in my third year, my roommate and friend Charlie Moore was killed in the ring, and he dropped a scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
So the scholarship went out the window. So with that, I decided to go into the service, and after I got out of the service, I decided to go in law enforcement and continue my education on a part-time basis until I received a master's degree from Valparaiso University. So after a number of years on the Gary Police Department, I rose in rank from patrolman to detective to sergeant to lieutenant and commanding officer, and at one point I was the administrative assistant to the chief of police. I decided somewhere along the line that I'd like to enter federal service, and I became a member of the United States Department of State Diplomatic Security Service.
That's interesting. And a lot of your time, I know you spent here in the States, I understand.
I did. I was working out of the Chicago field office, and I coordinated security for 128 foreign consulates. I also assisted in coordinating training for foreign dignitaries and training for foreign police officials.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have, unfortunately, a lot of time to spend today to talk, but I do want to have you back and join us and give us more detail about your career working with the consulates and all for the State Department. It's very interesting, and I'm sure that our listeners would want to hear more about that. We're talking with Wally DeRose, who is a native of Gary, graduate of Emerson High School, and has a very interesting career, as well as what we can glean, I guess, from what you've learned in life about being a boxer and how you have, I guess, it teaches you some lessons in life as well, too, I understand.
A lot of humility.
I would imagine. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Listener Supported, Lakeshore Public Radio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The world of country music has been dealing with the aftermath of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history, which happened at a country music festival in Las Vegas. The organizers of the Country Music Association Awards, happening this week, wanted to keep the focus on the music and barred questions from reporters about gun control. They've since apologized and lifted the restrictions. That's next time on Here and Now. Tune in at 2 p.m. for Here and Now here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
On Tuesday the 7th, voters in the city of Hobart are being asked to make some very important decisions for the health of the school district. The program is entitled Vision 2020 for the Brickies, a capital investment for the school city of Hobart. It's the special referenda vote that is being asked of residents to participate in, and we have with us to talk about it and give us some of the thinking and the reasons behind the request for the referenda. Superintendent Peggy Buffington is with us. Dr. Buffington, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak about Vision 2020.
This is a very, very important initiative for the school city of Hobart, and I would not be surprised if more school districts across Northwest Indiana, if they have not done so already, which some have already in the past, if more of them are taking this up again, too. There's a reason that school districts have to seek additional funds from their residents to cover the expenses of operations, as in this case with the city of Hobart, but also to looking to the future. And we're talking about capital investments here. Tell us, if you will, first, the situation that the school city of Hobart is facing as far as the economics of operating a school system is concerned, and how the state funding situation makes it very difficult these days.
All right. So that's one of the questions that will appear on the ballot, is speaking about the operational referendum. And for the school city of Hobart, it's been we've been extremely fiscally responsible. As you well know, back in 2008-2009, that's when schools started being funded their general fund by the sales tax versus property tax. And so the sales tax, it's been a little bit challenging for school corporations, particularly in the year of 2009. 2009, as you know, the recession kicked in, and school corporations were told in the middle of January that their budgets were going to be cut. And really, some of the neighboring school corporations around have gone out on referendas, specifically back from that 2009 cut that the school corporations took. The school city of Hobart, we faced $1.2 million in cuts back in 2009. So we basically at that point had just opened up our brand new high school, and we're very fiscally responsible in the sense that when we built the high school, we wouldn't build the high school without being cognizant of the fact that the board did not want to raise the tax rate. So we waited until we absolutely would not raise taxes to build the high school. We just thought there's no way we can go to the taxpayers about this $1.2 million until we make some cuts. So we made significant cuts. We consolidated four elementary schools into three elementary schools. We offered early incentive retirements, and we basically cut 15 staff members. We opened up the Early Learning Center. We were one of the first around here to offer a full-day kindergarten program, and we used the full-day kindergarten grant to help pay for those teachers. So we made those $1.2 million cuts, and then now comes at that same time they imposed the tax caps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we watched people around the state really, really struggling with the property tax caps, which are meant to be a wonderful thing unless you're a taxing unit where you have to operate based off of the budget that you've been given, and then all of a sudden there's going to be massive reductions in the revenue that you're getting because of the tax cap. So as we did our research on it, and you know, for the taxpayers to understand that the tax cap for homeowners, specifically 1% of your assessed value is all your tax bill will be, mm-hmm. and then you know, landlords would be, and farmers 2%, business owners 3%. So when you look at that, let's just say the $100,000 home, your bill used to be $1,500. It's going to be capped at 1%, which is $1,000. That's wonderful news. But on the other hand, that $500 that you saved is also a reduction to the taxing units. We know in the school city of Hobart, all of that adds up to $2 million in loss in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's very painful. And I can just tell you that, you know, seeing how we face those 1.2 million cuts, you really would have to start just chipping away at so much to recover 2 million in lost revenue. So, and people say, so what have others done? Well, I think down in Franklin County, the easiest thing for most school corporations to look at is their transportation budget because it's a larger line item.
Right.
Otherwise, you're chipping away at athletics, early college classes, performing arts, and no one wants to do that to programming. For the school city of Hobart, our transportation budget is exactly $2 million. And no one wants to look at that either. So one of the things that we did is working with our financial planner, we actually looked at what happens in 2020 when Lake County and St. Joseph counties are faced with that tax cap because we were exempt from it until 2020. So what we did is we said, what would it take to generate that $2 million back and not impose such heartache, what was supposed to be a great thing for the taxpayers? So we looked at it, and we know with the legislators, they extended how long you could go out for an operational referendum for 8 years. And we said, well, gosh, we don't really need that until 2020. But let's see how much it would cost to get the $2 million back and just be the same, not anything more, just operate the same. We looked at it and we knew that if we raised taxes by 0.24, 24 cents in 2020, even though we're going out for it now, we would not levy for it until 2020,
mm-hmm.
that the average homeowner, $128,000 and up, I believe it even starts at $101,000, but the average homeowner in Hobart is a $128,000 house, that really they would still see tax relief. And so we propose a neutral tax solution to our community and just saying that if you give that back to us, the $2 million that we're losing, you still are going to see some relief in your taxes. And that allows us to operate, and you still can just be neutral with, you know, like if nothing even happened, you would still see some relief in your tax bill.
We're talking with the School City of Hobart Superintendent Peggy Buffington about what is being called Vision 2020 for the Brickies, which is a capital investment program set up for the School City of Hobart, not only to meet future operational expenses, as you're hearing here, because of the changes in the taxing system that Lake County in particular is going to face in the year 2020, but also looking to the future as far as buildings are concerned. And Dr. Buffington, you mentioned here about the fact that you have a new high school, but you want to make other improvements, and I'm sure that probably other buildings in the Hobart School District probably are getting to the point that they need to be repaired or maybe even replaced, I understand.
Well, and you're absolutely correct in terms of taking care of our facilities. You know, when we built the high school, we commissioned a community group. They were our feasibility study. And, you know, we did an extensive study for a year on all of our buildings. And really, their two charges was to be fiscally responsible and take care of our assets, which are our buildings, for our Brickies. And so, believe it or not, that group, we could afford to build a middle school, and they said, don't do that. Build a high school. And we said, we can't afford it. And so the board, being good stewards, we just paid down all of our debt, and we waited to not be – we did not want to raise taxes, and we just waited. And then, lo and behold, we have this amazing high school for our students, and it's been such an asset to the community. Along in that same feasibility study, though – you know, we had our eye on Ridgeview. It's an elementary school that was built, and it's, you know, it's quite old. When we're looking at how old that building is, it's, you know, it was built back in 1955. There are still portions of the building that we could use, but it really doesn't serve the population that's there. It's not ADA compliant. Its basement is 20 foot, it's a 20 foot difference than the front of the building. And the gym and cafeteria share the same space. And we actually shuttle kids from Ridgeview when they reach around 300 to our other elementary schools.
I see.
So it's really significant that, you know, we can keep that building over there. It's very low operational and use it for small things in our school district. But to take the Mundo property that we own and build a new elementary school, on top of that, we also would be alleviating Joanne Martin School. That's, its capacity is around 760, 770, but their cafeteria when they built that school was reduced because of budgetary concerns. And so when you have six sections of, let's say, fourth grade, they all can't fit in the cafeteria, and you're actually running five lunch hours.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
When you're running five lunch hours, you have to have put two of them in an arena that's eating cold lunch or something to that effect.
I
we
see.
Know we can take the Mundo population, which is in the neighborhood by our property, and if we combine the Mundo neighborhood with Ridgeview, you have a balanced enrollment in your district. And so that's really significant. And then the other part of the capital improvements that we're looking at would be when we first built the high school, when we proposed that to the Department of Local Government Finance, they were under new guidelines. And under the new guidelines by the state, they set a dollar figure. And they said you have to cut the pool out of your project. You don't really meet those guidelines. We were over a little bit. We even tried to say, well, you know, Lake County, very different than the middle of the state in terms of when you're building a project and the cost for labor union, which, you know, we embraced here. But the fact is that we had to cut the pool out of the project. Right now, I don't have swimming and pool instruction at my high school. And I have kids that are athletes that travel back and forth from the high school to the middle school. And basically, let's just look at our swim team as an example.
Mm-hmm.
They do 5:30 practices in the morning, and then they head down to the high school and be to class at 7:45. At 2:40, they're on their way back to the middle school preparing for practice or competition. That's just one set of athletes. So we're missing instruction, we're not serving our population in terms of our athletes, and then on top of that, when we had to cut the pool, we also lost PE locker space. So we took a look at our capital projects, and we also have some boiler replacements at the Early Learning Center, Martin and Liberty, that we need to take care of, and we said, how do we go back to the public, totally separate from operational, which is really important for the public to understand. You cannot spend capital on operational, but look at your capital project and say, how do we go back to the taxpayers and offer them some solutions that do not raise their taxes? So what we did is we paid down debt. We refinanced the high school on the same terms at a much lower interest rate and saved millions of dollars. It opened up some capital, and if you kept your tax rate exactly the same as it's always been, even back when we built the high school, it's opened up room for a $40 million capital improvement, and the tax rate wouldn't go up at all.
That's great.
And you could have a pool in elementary school, fix some of those larger capital expenditures like boilers at the building. And so we're offering a neutral tax rate to our community. And these are wonderful solutions right now because the interest rates are so low, it allows us to be able to go to the public and say, we can do this right now, and you won't even notice it on your tax rate or your bill.
Now, Dr. Buffington, you've had an opportunity to talk with citizens here in the weeks prior to the upcoming referendum questions that are going to be on the ballot on Tuesday the 7th. What kind of reaction have you gotten from residents in Hobart about what is being planned here? Are they pretty much of the same mind that they want to see the school district be stable, not only financially, but academically, and they're supportive of this?
Well, I probably have done about 50 presentations, and I know once people listen to the presentation, the reaction has been, this makes totally wonderful sense for our community, because quality schools mean you have a quality community which people want to live in and raise their families. So it's been really great feedback when they come to a presentation. Sometimes I believe that when people, you know, are on social media, they may hear something, and the best thing to do is to always call here if you have a question. So, for an example, on Sunday when the editorial ran in the Times, people were saying, I think my taxes are going up. And so we saw some people with activity, and so we tried to help them out. We have a tax calculator on our website, and we say, go put your assessed value in. And so, you know, there was one patron that I said, I walked her through it. I said, put your assessed value in, and she saw her taxes were going down $1,006 in 2020. So I think when there's misinformation out there, that causes concern. But for the most part, people have received it very well. They love our high school. They love our community. They love what we offer to children here in Hobart. And we have a fine tradition here with the Brickies. And I think that we offer a very tax-neutral solution. And, you know, people say, this makes perfectly good sense. I think the largest concern that we've heard is, what are you doing with Ridgeview Elementary School? And listening to the community, that to me would be what their biggest concerns are.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to say that portions of that building will continue to be used. And let me give you an example. We have Head Start at our Early Learning Center, which is growing by leaps and bounds. And we all believe in early education. I'm a huge proponent of it. It's so important. We propose to move Head Start over to Ridgeview. That opens up space at the Early Learning Center. Then on top of it, we also have a hospitality program at our high school, and we would love to use that kitchen in our hospitality, career, and technical ed division, if you would, and move it over there and use that kitchen space. We know that we have an entrepreneurship class as well. We wouldn't have 300-plus users trying to use our electrical grid and one-to-one technology, so it's a perfect use to move that hospitality program over there. We're also looking at NYSEC, which is the 9 districts that serve special needs here in Lake County. We have an adult special ed program, a couple of class spaces for that, where they meet as adult special needs learners to get tooled for going out into the world of work, and then their cooperative teacher takes them out for their employment. And it's right there on off of I-65. Provides a great opportunity. So we're looking at about 5 classrooms and using our cafeteria. It's a great opportunity to just use the good portions of that building without having to worry about ADA accessibility on the bottom floor, overcrowding, being able to use just the spaces that we need and not taxing the electrical grid. So we have a really good solution, and most of those things offer room rent, which helps offset the operational cost of the building.
Well, Dr. Buffington, it sounds like that you and members of the school board there in Hobart have planned this out, have worked this out, and had a chance to talk with the public about this. And we hope that things work out well, certainly with people who have cast their votes a bit early, as well as those who will be going to the polls. That'll be all open in the city of Hobart on Tuesday the 7th and make their decision about the 2 referenda questions. We've been talking with the school city of Hobart's Superintendent Peggy Buffington about the upcoming referenda questions that will be on the ballot in the city of Hobart for improvement and operational expenses of the school district. Dr. Buffington, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, and Bricky up.
One of the school corporations here in Northwest Indiana that is turning to patrons and to voters in their community is School City of Hammett, joining colleagues in Hobart in asking voters at the polls on Tuesday, November 7th, to answer yes or no to 2 public questions. To find out more about the questions that the School City of Hammett is posing to its voters, we have Superintendent Walter Watkins. Dr. Watkins, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, not a problem. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. The conversation I had earlier with Superintendent Peggy Buffington of the School City of Hobart about the questions that they are offering to their voters in particular. One of the things that we brought up, take a look at the issues that school districts, not here in Northwest Indiana necessarily, but everywhere in the state of Indiana, have to face these days in dealing with financing. And we've talked about this, I know, seems like forever, in the past, about how it's affected the city of Hammond School District in particular. If you will tell us in this public question coming up among the 2 that you have on the ballot, so to speak, that'll be considered for the residents on Tuesday the 7th, how does the operating expenses portion of what you have to work with from the state of Indiana fit into this particular question?
Let me begin, first of all, by letting you know that I have with me 2 of my colleagues here. I have Alicia Pritchett, who is the Executive Director of Business Services, and James Burgraff, who is the Executive Director of Building and Grounds. So we'll kind of play off each other in terms of getting answering these questions and getting the information out there that
that's
you're
right.
asking.
That's right. Thank you, and welcome to you, Alicia, and to James for joining us as well, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the operating referendum is the referendum that really will look at covering some important issues that we need in terms of staffing, in terms of bus transportation, in terms of bringing 21st century programs into our schools and educating kids for the future as they graduate from school. Alicia has a little bit of information about that, or far more information about that, since she is the kind of the one of the money people. Mm-hmm. So I'll let her respond to that if that's fine.
So basically, what has happened in 2016, our school formula was changed, whereby we received money from the state for two major categories in the school formula, which is the foundation and the complexity index. Well, when you hear that the state has given more money for schools, that is true as it relates to the foundation. However, what has happened, they have pulled money away from school districts who were getting the additional funding for the complexity index, which was basically the foundation basically pays for your normal school operation, general school operations. The complexity index helps cover the additional expenses that you need that goes over and beyond what's needed for general operations. Our district has been cut. Starting in 2016, we've lost over $3 million due to this change in the school formula. And if you compile that every year, you're looking at between 2.5 to 3 million every year of funding that the school district should have had, but because of the change in the school formula, we did not receive. That was one of the major factors in why, you know, where school districts are facing deficits in some cases because of the change in the school formula. And another reason is because of the change in how much the school districts are capped at receiving as it relates to capital project funds. Mm-hmm. In the school district of Hammond, we have over 20 buildings, and due to the state law that occurred in 2005 as to how much you could really receive from the capital projects fund, we were capped at that amount. But since 2005, you know, our school district basically expenses have grown because, you know, you're looking at more buildings, more expenses. You know, the buildings have got basically aged, you know, in over time. Mm-hmm. So that's another major reason. And you know, we look at the property tax cap that for the school city of Hammond, we lose over $2 million a year in as a loss due to the property tax cap that was put into the Constitution by the state.
I also know, too, that Lake County and St. Joseph County are going to be facing in 2020 a big change that will happen as a result of the caps that are put on taxes.
That is very true. So in 2020, the additional cap that, like for the city of Hammond, has been $1.18 that has been put on tax bills over and above the cap. That money that school districts and other taxing units in the city, in the applicable cities in Lake County and St. Joseph County, will no longer receive those additional funds due to the waiver rules expire in 2019. So in 2020, you're absolutely correct that additional funding for the exempt debt will be eliminated.
So I take it that you all feel confident that what you're asking the voters for in this first question that'll be on the ballot on November 7th will raise enough to be able to, at least you'll feel that you have the pad that you need to be able to meet the future expenses and not overtax anybody, literally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Let's take a moment here to talk about the second question, which is the one that seems to, it's almost as important as what people pay in taxes. It's the facilities, and you've talked a little bit about the age of facilities in the school city of Hammond, and in particular, one of the big issues that has come up here is the question about a possible bond issue, I should say, or a lease, depending on which, I guess, the school board feels is most feasible, to build a new high school. Give us an idea of how the high school stands right now and what you're hoping for if the voters in Hammond approve this.
Well, Bob, this is James Burgraff, mm-hmm. Executive Director for Buildings and Grounds, and I'd be happy to address that question.
Thank you.
The school city of Hammond has 25 buildings, and the newest new building is 10 years old already. So all of the other buildings are older than 10 years, and Hammond High School is 100 years old this year. And that building has been on the slate for replacement for many years, and it's just not getting any better. So that facility, it's already been decided that we would do something with it as far as replacing it with a middle high school facility on the same site. And And so we are we're looking at doing that as well as making certain that we can do all of the other needed facility infrastructure replacements and repairs at the remaining 24 buildings throughout the district. And that's to make certain that we can maintain the taxpayers' investments as well as make certain that these buildings are safe and conducive to the educational process.
So you're looking at at improvements, yes. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Before you go any further, let me say that I know you've heard two pieces of information that kind of conflict here. Ms. Pritchett said that we had 20 buildings, and Mr. Burgraff said we had 25 buildings.
All the 20 buildings.
We have 20 school buildings, and the district has 25 buildings overall. I didn't want any of your listeners to say,
There are other buildings that the school district owns and takes care of, which are not instructional buildings, I suppose. You're talking administration buildings and other buildings like that, facilities and things like that, true. And you're talking improvements to elementary schools. Maybe it might be a case where you may have to replace a boiler in a building or a roof or something like that. But all of these do cost money, and you have to figure these in if you want to make the improvements in the future. So this is all parcel of the overall capital improvement program, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. We have a number of things that we have to address at all of these buildings, and especially those that are older than 10 years. As you know, things wear out. Roofs wear out. The finishes inside of the building, meaning carpeting and flooring materials, those all wear out. But one of the things that we are always looking at is our ways of making certain that we have comfortable and efficient environments. And so our HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning systems throughout the district require some tweaking in some cases and some full replacements in others.
Right.
So that kind of dovetails into that comment you said about boilers. Mm-hmm. But we also have chillers for chilled water during the summer months that are at their final legs and beyond as far as their longevity. So we have some things that we have some challenges ahead of us to get taken care of at all of our facilities.
And we're talking, according to the public question number two that's listed here, the maximum that you're looking at to be able to get the financing authority would be about $110 million. And one of the things, if I may, I'd like to ask a couple questions as we kind of wrap things up here, is to talk a little bit about what kind of impact that the questions financially, if the voters approve it, will have on the average homeowner taxpayer in the city of Hammond?
So basically, the average home in Hammond is $80,000. So for the year of 2018, the additional, if the homeowner qualifies, and most residents do, for a homestead deduction, then taking that into consideration, mm-hmm. the amount of the annual tax, in addition to what they're currently paying today, will be $86.90. And that's roughly about a little over $7 more a month. In 2019, the annual amount that a homeowner will be paying in addition to what they're currently paying in this year will be $93.73. That's not a compounded amount. That's the actual amount that they'll pay in addition to what they're currently paying this year. However, in 2020, as you just mentioned, when the exempt debt rate goes is no longer applicable for homeowners, well, actually all taxpayers, then our rate is $1.18 for the city of Hammond. However, with both the capital and operating referendum, those two rates combined comes to 80 cents. So basically, it's like a 36 cents, I believe, difference between the what will be coming off of the homeowners' tax bills and what will be going on in 2020. So actually, taxpayers in the city of Hammond will actually see a decrease in their current bill in 2020 over what they're currently paying this year.
What kind
That's an example of how much a homeowner will be paying, and that's, like I said, that's the average assessed home value in the city of Hammond. Just if I want to go on the higher end, just say for about 20% of homeowners that might be at the higher end of $150,000 home, that would be an additional $287.10 for the year of 2018 and $309.68 for the year of 2019. However, in 2020, again, the homeowners will see a reduction in what they're currently paying in this year over what they will actually be paying in the year of 2020. So the way I try to tell people is that there's basically look at it as a five-year return on your investment. That yes, we're asking for an additional tax amount for the years of 2018 and 2019, but in 2020, year 2021 and 2022, you will have received actually that additional amount that we're requesting for 2018 and 19. That money would have been returned to you in the latter 3 years. So it's like a five-year return on the taxpayer's investment, you know, but again, you're adding on to the viability of the city, and it is an investment in the city, investment in the children's education. And one thing I would say for the school city of Hammond, we've held out on asking, going to our taxpayers, asking for money for a capital versus operating, whereby some districts are now at the point of asking for renewal on their operating or on their operating referendum.
Right.
We have not done that. There's 10 districts in our region that have already approved, where the voters have already approved either operating, capital, or both.
We have about a minute left here in the conversation. Superintendent Watkins, will you give us an idea from all of the number of public meetings that you've had talking about the referenda going back into September, what kind of reaction have you gotten from the public so far as we come up to the actual voting day on Tuesday the 7th?
Well, Jim, I'm sorry, Chris, this is my perception. You know, we started out of the gate kind of slow. It was a new process for us, so it was a learning experience for us as well. But I think here over the past 2-3 weeks, we've gained a lot of momentum, a lot of positive reaction, and some considerable support in what we're asking for taxpayers on Tuesday. So we're just trying to get the word out, talk about all the positive things that this referendum can eventually lead to, not only for the school city, but for the city as well. And I think we're beginning to see some dividends pay off for that.
And Chris, we do have our website that for any additional information, which is our website is www.hammond.k12.in.us. There is, and when you pull up our homepage, there is a section right in the middle of our homepage for homeowners, taxpayers to go to. We click on, it says referendum information, tells you about all the facts, all the financial information. We have the calculators out there so homeowners can put in their own home values to determine how much this will impact them. So we're really trying to be as transparent can be, you know, as far as letting our taxpayers know what would be the true impact and what are the actual facts as it relates to the operation of the district and the achievements that we have done in the school city of Hammond as it relates to academic progress and success.
We've been talking with the school city of Hammond Superintendent Walter Watkins and his top staff about the issues and the questions that have come up here as the November 7th referenda questions come forth to residents of the city of Hammond about what the school district is seeking from them. Thank all of you for being with us today to talk about this. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
A reminder that the polls for today's special elections in Hammond and in Hobart will close at 6 p.m. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.